My name's Mel, I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
Geez, you know, when I saw Bill get up there to start this morning off, I thought, you know, I'm done, I'm never going to talk. Because some of you know Billy well, know he really likes that podium, but we got the cane up there, and thanks, Bill, and thanks to all the guys who are doing what you're doing, and thanks for inviting me to speak. It's hard not to be nervous, you know. A lot of smiling faces. That's good. So I guess we talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, right? Yes, people are nodding. I guess. Unless what? What's the alternative? Oh, it's going to be exciting, Jimmy. There's a big book up here, and I'll tell you a story about this newcomer who was having trouble. It was in his first couple of months of sobriety, and he was just all messed up. And one of the areas he was messed up in, as many of us have experienced, was sex. And he went to his sponsor, and his sponsor said, you know, go to the book. You know, the sponsor was always putting him to the book. And he said, you know, sex is written about on page 69, right? I'm sure they did that on purpose, right? That can't be a coincidence. So anyway, this guy was so messed up that he went to page 96. And here's what he read. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. So, it's all in the book. It's all in the book. So, you know, my childhood was interesting. I actually have reviewed, you know, what I want to say, and it was all I could do not to take notes. And as some of you know, I'm a professional, and I speak in a professional sense a fair amount, and I speak from notes, and, you know, I talk about facts, and I have slides, and, you know, that I could do in my sleep. But this is a lot harder, you know. So I don't have any. Well, I do have a few. There's two things I wrote down on the back of this stupid ticket. I bought an extra ticket. I want $5 back. And Matt, since you won the raffle, I think you should buy lunch on Monday, regardless of what you did with the money. I don't care. You know, there's very little excuse, right? Anyway, you know, I grew up on Long Island. I was raised in a very Jewish household, not Orthodox, but Jewish, and in a very Jewish community in Long Island. And if you know what that's like, we allowed non-Jews there, but I didn't know quite what they were. You know, I don't think we had any black people in my high school. I mean, it was really a pretty affluent place. And you know, as I think back at, you know, when I prepared or thought about making a pitch, I realized that from the very beginning, I didn't feel very good about myself. And I didn't know what was going on, but I always felt awkward. And, you know, the reason at that time was we lived on the other side of the tracks. I mean, literally, there was the really rich part of this community, and then there was the part of the community that I lived in with my folks. And we were fine, you know. We were well off. We ate well, and my dad worked really hard. He had a manufacturing company, and he sold. And I remember him working really hard. But I just remember not feeling like everybody else, you know, like not as good, not as rich, not as smart. I was a fat kid. I know it's hard to believe, but, you know, I was really round, and I had a terrible self-image. I couldn't throw a ball. Sort of threw like a girl, and, you know, I got made fun of a fair amount, and I don't know, I just internalized this sense of myself that was less than. And, you know, I say that because I know a lot of people relate to that. I hear it a lot in meetings that, you know, we grow up with a sense that we don't fit in and we don't belong. And, you know, as my life went on, different things came up that about which I was different. You know, there was all those things I told you. I was attracted to men early, you know, and probably when I was 7 or 8. And I didn't know what to make of that. You know, it was just a terrible conflict. I was terribly ashamed of it. But it was who I was, you know. I mean, if anybody wonders if you're born with it or not, I can tell you I was born with it. But I was very ashamed of myself. And I was a high achiever. Educationally, I was pretty smart, and I did well in school and excelled. And that was of great value in my family. I have an older brother who was smart, but he excelled in sports. He won the award for best all-around guy in high school, you know, and I was 4 years younger than him. So I was always Larry Pohl's brother. And it was not a particularly good position to be in. And he was kind of a jerk off. He tells me that he didn't do anything that any other older brother doesn't do to a younger brother. But when I was in therapy, when I was, I don't know, 20 or 22 years old, I accused him of abusing me physically. And I mean, he used to beat me up. You know, my parents would go out and he would punch the crap out of me and sort of do this minor torture, you know, and nothing sexual, but just he was really, really terrible to me. And, you know, he said, oh, you know, all older brothers do that to younger brothers. And we, you know, we sort of had it out, and he's one of my best friends now. He really is. So, you know, you get to work through a lot of things through recovery and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I certainly have had the opportunity to do that. But when I was younger, he was not my friend. He was not my ally, and you know, I really didn't feel like people were on my side. So, and I remember the sense of self, you know, that sense of awkward, not fitting in, being different. I was bar mitzvahed at the age of 13, which is pretty traditional for Jewish boys, and I excelled at my studies, and I did the service which you participate in, and I remember sitting behind, sort of like there, and the rabbi was talking about me, and he loved me. I used to babysit for his kids. I mean, I was just a really, you know, I was one of those good kids, but deep down I didn't feel very good. And he was saying all this good stuff about me, and I remember in my mind thinking, oh, if they only knew. You know, and people were looking at me like you're looking at me with, you know, it was my family. They were people who loved me. But I, deep in my soul, felt like I was defective. You know, there was something really wrong about me and bad about me. And it was absolute. It would never be okay. You know, that's the way I felt. And as I grew up, That sense of shame and, you know, sort of internalized sense that I wasn't all right just became a part of me. And I went through high school and I did okay and I graduated. I decided that what I would do, I would break the mold. My brother went to school in Buffalo, New York. It was sort of a New York kind of thing. I went to school in Michigan, all the way in the Midwest, which was really bizarre for a Jewish kid from New York. You know, nobody could understand why I ended up there. And I thought, well, here I'll develop my own identity. And I did on some levels. I was in a dorm and then in a fraternity, and I discovered alcohol. And I started to drink on weekends with the guys. And, you know, I remember a number of times getting really, really, really drunk and remembering that it was particularly, it was a good feeling. I mean, no, it was a great feeling, you know. And anything that seemed to be wrong with me was temporarily right. I mean, when I got, you know, a couple, three beers in me, which is what we usually drank when I was in college, you know, my anxiety leveled out and my feelings about myself, I became part of everybody and, you know, I was funnier and I was more relaxed and, you know, I was where I wanted to be. And I can remember from the first few times that I drank, the sensation that after a couple or three, the thought that would go through my mind until thoughts left my mind, you know, but as my mind would go on, it would be, geez, this is something. When can I do this again? You know? And I have this feeling that people who don't have alcoholism don't get that, you know? But I, you know, at the time, who knew when, you know, I was probably 20. And I have to tell you that a good part of my story is related to drugs. So if there's any pure alcoholics in the room, Lou, I apologize, but I'm going to talk about drugs, and I certainly hope it doesn't offend anybody. But my story wouldn't be complete without talking about my drug use, and you know, the next drug that came across my lips was marijuana, and I vowed I was never going to smoke pot because it was bad and wrong, and it was a gateway drug, you know. And I lived in this dorm with guys who, and you know, alcohol led to marijuana, and they got a hold of some pot, and it was a big old deal, and I wasn't going to smoke, and so I sat there like a judge, you know, and I watched them get high. I remember they had this water pipe, and I remember the sound of that pipe, and I remember watching them, you know, and I was drinking beer, And they were having fun. I mean, they were really having fun. And, I gave it a little thought, and the next week they were getting stoned, and it was like, give me some of that. And I got some of that, and I'll tell you what, that probably was my favorite drug of any drug, was marijuana. I mean, I loved getting high on pot. And, over the years, if there was a drug of choice, I smoked pot every day, probably close to from then till when I got sober in 1984. So that was, a good 20 years of daily marijuana use. I just love smoking pot, and it wasn't like an ounce a day, it was just a joint or two or three, and, but I was always smoking more than everybody else. I mean, I had a partner, and, he'd take a toke, and I'd smoke the rest of the joint, and then I'd be looking for roaches around the house, and sometimes I'd go out to the car, it was just, I was compulsive about it. But it made me feel right, it made me feel good, it made me feel smarter, and, around that time, I also started having sex. I had girlfriends all along, and I don't know what they thought, but I it wasn't quite a fulfilling experience for me or for them. But when I started having sort of covert sex with guys, and that shame about who I was always there. I remember I was in a fraternity. And it was my second year in college, and I remember writing this diary. I started a diary, and I remember just like it was yesterday. I mean, I wrote down and I said, in this journal, I'm going to tell my innermost secrets about everything. I'm going to figure things out. I'm going to tell about who I really am. Of course, I can never talk about it, And I was not, that was true. I thought there's me and there's it, And as time went on, I had different its in my life, that my alcoholism became my it, and my drug addiction became my it. So there was this division between who I seemed to be and who I believed I was, which was this guy who's going to get married and have kids and live a, sort of a normal life. And then there was who I really was, which was a gay man in development, So I proceeded through my college years with a lot of conflict, needless to say. And I discovered different drugs. I discovered LSD and mescaline. Love tripping. I did. I have to. If you never did it, Lou, you really missed out. Yeah. No, it's too late. No, it's too late. And I discovered, stimulants and a little cocaine, but not. It's like I tried cocaine. It was like no big deal, until later. But to be continued, So I did decently in college, and I lived sort of a dual life. I mean, I was in a fraternity. By the way, in terms of my identity, there were a number of fraternities that I rushed and who were interested in me. The fraternity that I joined was identified as the douchebag fraternity, sort of like the nerds and the guys who just really weren't particularly cool. That's the fraternity I elected to join, And it's because that's where I felt I belonged, And we reinforced each other's sense of inadequacy. Meanwhile, I'm going off and having sex with guys, on the side. So my self-esteem was really not terribly good, though I was, doing pretty good and I was excelling in college. And I eventually got into medical school and went on to medical school. In medical school, a number of different things happened. I fell in love with a woman and started living with her eventually and thought we were going to get married. And I fell in love with a man. And that was a bit of a conflict. All I could get out verbally was that I was bisexual. I mean, gay was not part of my identity at that time. And, it sort of went on like that. I went to therapy. I tried to be straight. I had this rubber band that I used to snap every time I wanted to go have sex with a guy, And it's ridiculous. The therapist said, if you don't want to do this, we'll make you stop, And 6 months later, he said, I think we're on the wrong track. I think maybe we ought to help you accept who you are. And, that was the beginning of my journey towards acceptance, but it was just the beginning because I was not ready to accept it. I didn't want to give up the fantasy that I actually could be normal, And the problem, that presented with that was that I was madly in love with this guy and ended up breaking up with my girlfriend and living with my lover for 24 years. So that was the transitional relationship that really created the permission for me to really be who I was, which was very conflicting because I was ashamed of who that person was. So, and guess what? If I drank or if I smoked pot or and Denny was, he was sort of a larcenous kind of guy. And he had this shoebox full of drugs. And, you know, we smoked pot and stayed up all night the first night we were together. And the next night I had to go to medical school. So he gave me some cross tops, White Cross. And I like them. You know, I like that speed. In fact, I like stimulants so much that under the influence of stimulants, I decided that I thought I had attention deficit disorder because this made me feel so good. You know, and I had to find some legal medicine, which I did, Ritalin. I really did. And I discovered cocaine, and I got into a serious, serious pattern of using cocaine on a regular basis. Only snorted it. I never smoked it, although I have to tell you that in terms of injection drugs, I was out at a bar, and I was very, very drunk. And this is it, you know. I mean, alcohol gave me permission to do all sorts of other stuff, smoked pot, went home with this guy who said, do you want to inject some meth, some speed? And I was like, no, what are you, crazy? And I was like, okay. That was it, you know? I mean, the barrier that I had drawn around that behavior was like, okay. Now, it so happened, thank God, it was too, I mean, it just really messed me up bad. I mean, I was a wreck, and I didn't like the experience. Now, I know today that had I had access and had I continued to do it, I would have grown to like it. I mean, I've talked to enough of you guys to know that it's really a likable substance, you know. And that in that way is really, so thank God, you know, and crack was not quite there. People were freebasing in my day, but crack was not out, or I would have been in deep trouble because I liked the experience of cocaine. So, you know, I mean, I got fairly heavily involved in regular use of different substances, always drinking, you know, always alcohol was always there to sort of enable me to just sort of do whatever else I wanted to do, whether it was sexual or drug or alcohol or drug related. My relationship developed. We were in Buffalo, New York at the time. I was in my residency and I don't know if I was physically dependent on it, but I mean, I was in charge of the hospital. There were two residents. And I was a pretty manipulative guy, you know, the way some of us are. And I would manipulate. We'd be on till 11. There were two residents. And at 11, whoever was done could go to sleep. We'd split the night, four-hour shifts. And I would work typically with my friend Roseanne, who was slow and methodical and always stop and talk. And, you know, invariably by 11, she had six things to do, and I was done with mine. So I'd say, you know, well, I'm going to go to bed first. And she'd say, oh, come stay up and talk. No, I'm not. And I would go up to my room, which was adjacent, you know, it was like down the hall in the hospital, but in this old sort of residence. And I would put a towel under the door, and I would smoke dope. You know, and I don't say that with any pride, but, I mean, it just gives you an idea how compulsive I was. Here I was in charge of the hospital. And 4 hours later, I was really in charge because she was asleep, and I was first call, and I was stoned. You know, but that was, you know, I mean, it, at the time I didn't really sort of analyze it out, but that's how involved in that drug I was. I would never think of drinking there, but I certainly, I mean, I was intoxicated a lot. And we moved out to Las Vegas in 1979. There's the irony. I got a job with a family. I was in family practice, and I got a job with a family doctor. And what he did was he was the medical director of, if you remember back, Raleigh Hills Hospital, which was a drug and alcohol treatment program. And he just sort of wrote me, incidentally, oh, by the way, every other weekend you have to cover for me at this alcohol hospital. You know, big deal. I didn't think much of it. And he said, well, Sunday morning, you know, I was there for the weekend. I came out Friday night. It was August, and it was so, you know, one of those windy August days at 115, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, I got off the plane. They didn't have those moving walkways, so we got out of the plane. And, you know, it was like blown away. It was hot as hell. And my cousin Susan, who was my drug dealer for many years, met us at, she lived here, she met us at the plane, and we got stoned beyond belief. I mean, I was so stoned, and we were in the old Castaways, and I can remember we were trying to open the door at the Castaways, and I was like, oh, this door won't open, you know, I need air. And it was, you know, it had one of those bars on the bottom that would prevent it from going, and none of the three of us could figure that out for the longest time. So the doctor calls me, tells me, you know, I'm going to meet you Saturday morning and we're going to go flying. He took me flying up over Mount Charleston. And I was like, I was sick. I was anxious. You know, I mean, I was a mess. And then Saturday night we went out and I blacked out. I mean, we were drinking so hard. We went to a bar, met some people, you know, just drunk, got home somehow, drove drunk, which I did on a regular basis, by the way. And, I was up 7 o'clock in the morning to go make rounds with him Sunday morning in this alcohol hospital. If you know about Raleigh Hills, you probably, a lot of young people there, but basically Raleigh Hills, they used to give you a drink and then give you a shot of stuff that would make you puke so that your mind would identify alcohol with puking. It was conditioned response treatment. So here I am, Sunday morning, hungover, sick as a dog, with these people, and they used to give them basins, so there'd be people lying in bed going, bleh! And here I am going, you know, thinking I should be lying down next to that guy. I swear to God, it was just this like paradox. But, you know, undaunted, I took the job, covered him on weekends, you know, became an expert in alcoholism. I mean, it was crazy. And he left town, and I became the medical director of Raleigh Hills Hospital. This was in 1981. I got sober in 1984. So for the next 3 years, talk about this dual life. I was the medical director of a drug and alcohol treatment program, telling people what to do, telling people how to get sober. Screwed up, you know? I used to do cocaine before I'd come and give lectures on cocaine. You know, this one nurse, she said, she came up to me afterwards. She said, Doc, you know, she said, you really are you have a powerful message. You give a great lecture. She said, but when you talk about the effects of cocaine, you should tone it down a little bit. You know, because I get this fire in my eyes, you know, oh, yeah. And I didn't know. I mean, you know, what I talk about sometimes with when I'm meeting with alcoholics in a treatment center where I now work is, you know, it's like just only in the deepest, most secret time in my own life, you know, like late at night, 4 a.m, you know, I'd wake up in the middle of the night with this horrible, sick feeling of what a hypocrite and a liar I was. And I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, you know, oh, God. And then I'd go, nah, you know. And I'd just go to work next day and tell people what to do and how to get sober and all that kind of stuff. And what happened to me was I went to a conference. It's called the Southeast Conference on Addiction, CCAD. And the keynote speaker there was Father Martin. Some of you may have heard. He's a brilliant guy, and he tells great funny jokes and stories. And Saturday night, as I was wont to do, I'd rented a car because obviously I couldn't stay in the hotel with the other drunks. And I went out, and this was a really spiritual conference. I mean, they had meetings all day long. And I went out, and I blacked out, and I drove around. And, I ended up in a parking lot at 5 in the morning. The sun was rising. I came home and 9 in the morning, Sunday, I packed my stuff, and I went to the spiritual meeting, you know, and I got the message. I was, you know, still drunk probably. I don't know how I looked. And I came home from that conference with two things. One was a real sense that I had a drinking problem. And that was probably the first time. And the other thing was Father Martin said, I don't care if you're alcoholic, but if you're treating alcoholics, you should go to AA. So I came home and I told my friend Andy, who is a psychologist that I worked with, I think I have an alcohol problem. And he was like, no, you don't. and it was like he was one of my primary enablers. He said, I don't really think you have. Do you have a family history of alcoholism? No. He said, do you drink every day? No. Do you shake when you don't drink? No. Well, so why do you think you have alcoholism? I said, well, I go out on Sundays and I get drunk and I drive. And he said, oh, no problem. Just don't do that. You know, call a cab. Okay, you know, sounds good to me. He's an expert in alcoholism too. So do you know how many cabs I called between then and the time I got sober? None. Never. Ever. I do drugs. I mean, I would be at a bar drunk and somebody would put brown powder in front of me. I can't tell you today what it was, and I would snort it up. You know, it didn't matter. I would do whatever came across my desk to get high. Anything. It didn't matter. I just wanted to change the way I felt because I felt so bad about myself. And the more I, you know, did this dysfunction, the more I felt out of place, like I was a big fat liar. So, but I started going to AA. There was an under the bridge group at Denny's. They have bulldozed the Denny's. It was under West Sahara. But I used to go like 3-4 times a week. There was a woman named Rose there. I made friends there. And I'd come as a visitor or a guest. And I learned some stuff about AA. I learned some stuff about God there, spirituality. And I liked that stuff. Because in Raleigh Hills, we didn't have AA. We just had, you know, puke therapy. And eventually we started doing AA because I said, you know, this AA stuff really makes sense. You know, it teaches people how not to drink. So, and I got this sort of head that is really good for you all, you know, that was that kind of thing. And then like Monday morning sometimes when I'd be on one of those drunks, drug weekends, you know, not sleeping and hungover, I'd be there and I'd think to myself, I should introduce myself as an alcoholic. Nah, you know, the story of my life. It was always that. So the end of my drinking was no more. I mean, it's not like it got worse. I didn't drink that much more. I never became physically dependent. I never to this day, thank God, got a DUI, though I probably drove drunk 1,000 times with joints in the ashtray. I had an accident. There was drugs in the car, you know. I mean, so I should have gone to jail many times, but it just never happened. And I think, I don't know for sure, but I think if I got a DUI, I would have had trouble staying as the medical director of the drug and alcohol. I don't know that for sure, but I think I would have. So, you know, I was the people that got all the consequences, I was just real close, but it hadn't happened. But one day we were up in Mount Charleston. I had vowed not to smoke pot. I'd cut out cocaine, and I decided I was never going to smoke pot again, and I was never going to do cocaine again. But we were at my friend Kevin's house, and we just had a couple beers, you know, casual. And then my partner and I drove up to Mount Charleston, and a guy who had been up there had left us a joint. And, you know, it's like, you want to get stoned? Sure. You know, so, you know, with and without a solemn oath, chapter 3, that was my life. I promised myself 1,000,000,000 times, I'm not going to do it the same, I'm going to change, blah, blah, blah. Stoned. On call, in the mountains. And I remember driving. We were going up to the lodge for dinner, and we drove out of Rainbow Canyon, and I was so screwed up. I mean, I had a couple more beers, so I was so drunk and stoned, I didn't know whether I turned left or right, and I was driving. And I thought, I cannot keep doing this. I can't keep doing this. And that was really my last drink and drug. That was it, my last drunk. Not terribly dramatic, you know, not terribly, you know, in terms of bottoms, you hear people's stories, but it was my bottom. I mean, I was in so much pain emotionally about the way I was living my life that I couldn't go on. I told Denny, and he was like, you know, you're crazy. I mean, you don't have a drinking problem. And at that, you know, that point, I was convinced enough that I believe that I did. So I stopped drinking. And that's the last drink and mood-altering drug I've had except for prescription for some Lortabs, but that was after surgery. And I'll tell you a little, you know, I got that prescription because I needed that prescription, and I took the first night I was in pain, and I took it, and I went to sleep, and the pain went away. And the next night, I took one, and I didn't go to sleep. And I was like, yeah, I remember that feeling. And the third night, the pain wasn't that bad, but I was going for that Lortab's bottle, you know, and I flushed them. So, but I mean, that was my last drunk, that undramatic thing. So now what? The director of a drug and alcohol treatment program. I can't be going to AA raising my hand. I mean, I was in the room with people who were patients of mine who had, you know, time, and I'm going to be a newcomer? So what did I, you know, I thought, well, I'm just not going to drink, you know, willpower. And I did, I was, my brother lived in San Diego, and I went and visited my brother in San Diego and went to a meeting there. And I remember this, it was a room, it was big, and they asked for newcomers, and I raised my hand just to try it out, you know. And they asked for visitors, and I raised my hand, and then they called on me, you know, to come and speak. You know, it was a call-on meeting. So I got up, and I said, now, there's one thing that happened at that meeting. They read from the big book, chapter 5, and it said, half measures availed us nothing. And I heard that. And I thought, uh-oh. You know, it's one of those behind-the-scenes kind of uh-ohs. But I got up there and I said, you know, this is the most amazing program. Those steps are terrific. And, you know, you can have it. You know, it's good for you. I don't want to do it, you know. And that's where I felt. I mean, I can't. How can I disclose that I have a drinking problem, you know? So that, again, the conflict. And I called my friend Maureen. Some of you may know her. She's also a doc. She is a minister. She was a nun. She's got a colorful past. But she was a friend of mine. And I called her up and I said, Maureen, guess what? I stopped drinking. And she was sober a year and a half at the time. And she said, oh, that's so cool. Where are you going to meetings? And I said, oh, you know, how can I go to meetings? And I told her my story. And she said, oh. She said, well, how do you feel? And I said, well, actually, I'm feeling pretty bad. I'm depressed. I got headaches every day. I can't sleep. I got stomach cramps. And Denny and I are fighting night and day. She said, good. When you want to feel better, call me and we'll go to a meeting. You know. It was really, I wanted to shoot her. And the next day she stopped off and got me my 12-step, little black book, the daily meditation book, which I still have today. You know, here's a little, you know. So, you know, I really was miserable. I didn't know what to do with all that stuff, you know, that shame and that guilt. And, oh, my God, I was, you know, it was terrible. So I went to a meeting at the Turning Point. Come on, you know, I don't belong here, you know, with you slimy people. Don't you know who I am? You know, blah, blah, blah. And this is what's going on in my mind. So, and I found my way to that men's stag meeting. This is 22 years ago. And I saw what was going on, and I didn't want any part of it. You know, there were people laughing. I remember these two guys, well over 300 pounds, hugging each other up in the front of the room, laughing, and, you know, just carrying on. And I swear to God, I thought to myself, not in a million trillion years. This is... And I'm gay, you know? I mean, it just looked so weird. And I don't... It's not what you think. I couldn't imagine being relaxed and sober and, you know, being affectionate like that with another guy, you know? Because that was not part of what I did, you know? I mean, I had my life and my life. And I didn't know what to do. It was tearing me apart. So I started going to that meeting and I heard stuff like 90 meetings in 90 days. Don't you know who I am? You know? I'm the director of a drug and alcohol treatment program. I'm busy. 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, and I'd hear people say, my life is AA. I go to 6 meetings a week, you know, I mean, 6 meetings a day, you know, and it's like, whatever, you know. I mean, not in a million years. And then I saw the steps on the wall, you know. Fourth step, fearless and searching moral. Not in a million years. Are you crazy? And then tell somebody about it. Do you know the secrets that I had in those days, you know? Bombshells, I thought. You know, there's a part in the 12 by 12, and this is one of the notes I wrote. It says, we are immature, self-centered, and sensitive. You know, oy, 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 what a combination. But that really is me. Very sensitive, very easily hurt. I'm the most important guy, and I'm a, you know, Wes Carpenter, anybody remember him? He passed not too long ago. Wes used to say, I'm the worst, nothing but a horrible piece of whale shit on the bottom of the ocean. But I'm a very special piece of whale shit. You know? And that was the story of my life. And you put alcohol in and everything is fine. But without the alcohol, I was splitting apart. And I met people like Wes. I went to the men's stag and I went to the floating big book meeting where there's some heavy hitters, as you all know. And, you know, I heard stuff. They would read the big book and they were reading about the fourth and the fifth step. And, you know, honest to God, I just... Not in a million years. That's what I said to myself. And, you know, that wasn't the truth. The truth was I had to do this stuff or I was going to die, you know, or I was going to, I don't know what. I don't know what would happen. But I could tell you that I was so miserable, I had to do something. And that's part of what I think kept me coming back. I mean, I came back almost every day. You know, I probably made 100 meetings in 90 days, even though I didn't realize it. And I think the reason, there was two. One was I was really afraid. About 2 weeks into it, I was having dinner at a friend's house, again, Kevin, And we had a nice little time, and I was sober. I wasn't drinking. I had started going to meetings, and they were smoking pot, I think, and they were, I don't know if they were doing cocaine, but they definitely were drinking, and I was watching and watching, and I thought I was fine. And then at the end of the dinner, he served this horribly disgusting orange liqueur. I can't tell you the name of it, but it was disgusting. Nothing I would ever consider drinking. And I thought, the thought came into my mind just as clear as day. You know, a sip of that might be really nice right about now. And I was like, what? You know, I wouldn't have drank that when I was drinking. You know, just like Bill Wilson in the Big Book when he talks about scotch and milk, you know, you can get away with it. And I want it, but I didn't drink it. And the next day, I used to go to the Thai club meeting on Sunday mornings, and I went there and I listened different, you know. And I heard people say, don't listen for the differences, you'll hear them. Listen for the similarities. And I started hearing people talk about the pain and the suffering and the dual identity, you know, the not fitting in and feeling bad about yourself. I heard that, and that made sense. And then I started going to the men's stag, and believe it or not, despite what you've heard today, there's some really good sobriety in that meeting. And there's some people who really know a lot of stuff. Most of them aren't going anymore, so that's... Actually, that isn't true. Most of them are going. You know, there's a lot of people, some of them are in this room, and you know, that have been there 25 years, people that were there when I got there, so which is pretty, you know, it's a pretty impressive record. But they would talk about things that were problems for me. They would talk about being depressed. They would talk about being lonely. They would talk about relationship problems. They would talk about anger. Whew. You know, I was a walking anger. I was walking anger. And my dad was a very angry person, so I identified anger as a powerful thing. I mean, even at Raleigh Hills, they used to send me in to yell at people because they weren't getting out of bed and doing what they were supposed to do. And I had more clogs in those days, and I don't know what I thought people thought of me, but you know, I'd clop into that room and I'd say, "You get out of bed, you lazy piece of crap! You know, what do you think you are? This is a hospital." You know, I was terrible. I was grandiose, you know, and angry, 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 and I didn't know what to do with it. You know, I realized that it was a problem. And then I just hadn't a clue. And I was an educated guy, you know. So there was, again, this dichotomy. Here I was a doctor helping people, and I didn't know what the hell to do with my feelings, you know. So I came to that meeting and I started to listen because you guys had solutions. And the solutions made a lot of sense, you know. Don't cultivate your anger or it'll turn into a resentment. I didn't get it at first. I had a lot of problem with justified anger, you know. And they had a whole meeting one day about justified anger, and basically the message was, get over it, you know. It's not doing you any good. And I was in agony, right? What are they talking about? These guys are insane. And I went up to a guy afterwards and I said, you mean to tell me if I'm right, I don't have I can't be angry? And he was like, well, tell me, how do you feel when you're that angry? Well, my stomach hurts and I get headaches and diarrhea and I want to die. Oh, well, okay. Stay as angry as you want for as long. Sounds like a good deal to me. But if you don't want to keep doing that, here are some ways to deal with it. You know, it's like, whoa, you know. A lot of the things I thought were working were not working. You know, being tough. Now, I know for some of my friends it's hard for you to believe, but I do have a macho identity, despite... I do. My therapist told me. So I get hurt, and I don't want to experience the pain of the hurt or the fear, and I act like a tough guy, you know, and I yell and I scream. And I still do that today. I don't do it nearly as much because I've learned time and time again that it doesn't work, but I'm still drawn to it, you know, irrationally, illogically. Sometimes it just, you know, it's like a magnet. Like a moth to a flame. Don't do it, you know? But I can't help it. It's part of my, I don't know, my habit. And I work really hard on it because it gets me in a lot of trouble, invariably. It gets me in trouble, particularly in the closest relationships in my life. So I started going to meetings. I went on a regular basis. I didn't understand the first step. I'm powerless over alcohol. I get that. My life isn't unmanageable. I mean, I'm a doctor, you know. I have a successful relationship, you know. I got an Audi. And he said... He said, well, you know, let's talk about the unmanageability of your life, how you feel, you know, how your life is working. And I had to admit that there was all this dysfunction in my emotional life that was driving me crazy, that was making me miserable. So we began to work. This is Rob with two B's, if you remember Rob. Passed away. Great guy. Wonderful man. And he said, this was a Saturday at the men's stag, I'll never forget. He said, well, do you have a sponsor yet? And I said, no. You know, because I'm not going to tell somebody. He said, you really should get a sponsor. He said, you know, there's like five or six guys around here I'll introduce you to who could be your sponsor. I was like, well, what about you? Well, you know, these five or six guys, really, I think he knew he was in trouble. And I said, no, I want you. And he became my sponsor. And we worked the third step. I got on my knees and we, you know, said the prayer. And I did a fourth step. And I did a fifth step, my first fifth step with Rob. And it was horribly painful. I don't know if any of you have done a fifth step, but, you know, in the fifth step, I guess the way they tell you to do it is that your pigeon shares something, and then you make them feel a little better by telling them something that you did, you know? So I had this list and pages and pages and pages of stuff I really wanted to get out of, you know. I wet my bed as a seven-year-old, you know? So I start, and Rob's like, oh, you did too. Well, let me tell you about when I went to camp and blah, 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 and, you know. So next I'm, you know, I had sex with a guy when I was 18 or 17. And, oh, really? Well, let me – and it was like, Rob, you know, I can't be listening to you for all night. I want to tell you this is my fifth step. I swear to God. And he was like, well, Mel, you know, here's how it works. So – 4 days later, you know, I was done with my fifth step, the way Rob had me do it. But, you know, it was the first time I really had told another human being really the exact nature of my wrongs or my perceived wrongs, you know. And it was pretty cool, you know. And I did a sixth and seventh, and, you know, he had me reading the book. He really gave me a good foundation. And I went on and had different sponsors over the years based on different things that happened to me. But my relationship with my sponsors has always been really key because it was one person who knew the whole story, you know, and there was a real value to that because they still love me, you know. And actually, my relationship with Denny was like that. Even though he was an alcoholic and he wasn't a sponsor, he knew me inside and out, and he loved me inside and out, you know, with warts and all is what we used to say. And that changed me, you know, the realization that I could be loved as I was, you know, not with the facade and not with the doctor and not with all that stuff. That was one of the most important things that ever happened to me, the sense that I was lovable. oh, this is going to get hard. Okay, so let me go a different way so I don't have to cry. There was a guy at one of the first meetings, probably in the first 3 months, who said there was a silk sheet drunk society. And I went up to him after the meeting and I said, I would like to know where that meets. Because that's where I belong. He just said, keep coming back, son. And this same guy said at a meeting one time, he said, alcoholism is the ill at ease disease. And damn it, that really got me, you know. And I was pissed. It was almost like, you know, you know how you do that? I didn't want to hear that. Because that meant this was a lot more than just not drinking, you know. Because when I came in, I just thought, no drinking, no drugs, go to meetings, you know. Boop, no more. And then little by little, you know, I heard what the solutions were. But when he hit that note of alcoholism is the ill at ease disease, it was like, that's what's been going on all this time. And that made sense to me, and I had to do something about that with myself and my identity and the way I related to people. So, you know, I've been sober a while. I go to a lot of meetings. I go to five or six meetings a week. I still work at a treatment center. I've gone to a number of different treatment centers, and I work at a place called Las Vegas Recovery Center. It's the best job I've ever had. I just love it there. people are very committed to recovery and sobriety, and it's good people to work with. I mean, I'm a lucky man on so many levels. I mean, I people say, oh, you go to work and you get sober, and you know, that's not the case. But it doesn't hurt, you know. I mean, being in a recovery environment all the time isn't my program, but it helps. You know, it enhances my sobriety. Because, I mean, I'll be telling people things that, and I try not to tell people what to do anymore. You know, I try and help them see what they might like to do versus what they might also like to do and pick that one. You know, that's kind of the therapy technique that I do most of the time. But I hear myself saying stuff, you know, and I see them saying stuff. And it really is, it tells me things, you know, it tells me things about myself. And I don't put myself separate from people, although I'd like to, you know. I mean, there's a part of me that would like to say, you know, you people, you know, different than me people. And, you know, there was a, early on, 6 months sober, they had a meeting, and the topic of the meeting was real sobriety. And the gist of the meeting was, you don't really, really get sober until, like, 5 years. And I'm 6 months, you know, and I'm getting pissed. I'm getting resentful. I'm getting angry. You know, I want them to call on me. They never call on me. You know? In that meeting, you never get called on. So finally, I think either somebody called on me or he probably saw me going, ooh, ooh, ooh. Or, you know, you stare at somebody when they're talking like you're really listening to them. So they'll call on you, you know. Now, Chris, I know you do that, but you just do that because you're interested, and I know that. I know. You know, so here I am, and they called on me, and I said, you know, you guys, you know, you've helped me a lot, and I don't know, you're full of crap, because I am sober 6 months. I have worked the first seven steps. You know, my amends list is ready, and I am sober. I got this thing. And, you know, they're like, you can imagine what it was like. You know, it's like, yeah, blah, 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 you know, whatever, kid, keep coming back. And, so I was really working on a resentment. So I went up to this guy, Charlie, afterwards, and I said, Charlie, I don't know what to do about this. And he said, Mel. Charlie was about 300 pounds, and he was old then, and he stayed around another 10, 20 years. But Charlie said to me, he said, what do you do for a living, Mel? Here was my chance. I'm a doctor, Charlie. And he's like, oh, he said, well, for you, it's different. I said, I knew it. He said, yeah, for you, it's 8 years. Merciless, you know. So I learned a lot of lessons in Alcoholics Anonymous, lessons about who I really am. You know, they talk about us all being 5'6". And, I struggle with that. My sense of self-importance is there all the time, you know. I'm on the phone. I want something. You know, just friggin' give it to me, you know. Well, you'll have to wait in line, sir, you know. Why? You know. And, you know, that desire to manipulate people to get what I want is still there. But the difference is today I know that if I'm waiting in line, and I'm sane, you know, sometimes I'm insane, or not insane, but, you know, I'm out of control and just driven by myself. But much of the time, I know I'm not supposed to get in first. You know, you're there before me. Just talk as long as you want, you know. Talk about the weather. Talk about the size that you want, you know. It's okay. You didn't get... I mean, I was at Target returning something, you know, and the woman in front of me had a life story to tell. I had two kitchen knobs to return, you know. And I waited and I waited and I waited. And finally I got to the thing and she's like, where's your receipt? I have my receipt. Where's the labels? Because I took them out of the plastic bag, of course. I saved the receipt. They didn't tell me to save the plastic bag. You'll have to go to the department and find the knobs and then bring them back to me. And it was all I could do not to. I said, thanks for nothing. That was what I said, you know. And I didn't curse her, so that was good. But I didn't feel really good about myself, you know. I feel better about myself when I act right, you know, when I do nice things, when I sincerely in the morning say hello to somebody who didn't say hello to me first, you know, that kind of stuff. And I learned a lot of what I know in Alcoholics Anonymous about how to feel good. But I also learned a lot about that I don't always feel good. You know, there's I study Buddhism. I've done that for about 6 or 7 years, and it's very congruent with Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I went to a Buddhist retreat, and there was a Buddhist AA meeting. So every morning, the drunks and the addicts would get together, and it was one of the coolest things I've ever done. Because we talk about recovery, and we talk about the teachings, you know, and they're very, very similar, very parallel. And I was actually listening to a tape on the way over, and this is one of the things I wrote down. Pain is not punishment. Pleasure is not reward. They're just occurrences. You know, they're just sort of natural things that happen in the world. You know, I'm in pain. It's not necessarily because I did something wrong. Now, I also believe somewhat in the philosophy of karma. So I believe, you know, like Earl, that if I behave good, that good things happen sooner or later, and it pays off. But that's not why I behave good. I behave good because I feel better. You know, it nourishes me. It nurtures me, and I become a part of the world. I remember for the first time I realized that the world was not about me, and my purpose in life was not to feel good. It was to be of service to other people. I didn't know that. I didn't, and I was a doctor, you know. I wanted my purpose in doing it was to get him out of the office with as few prescriptions as possible and have him say, God, you're a good doctor. You know, that was my purpose. And eventually it just sort of evolved into, oh, I can do the right thing and really do my best to take care of people, and they really appreciate it and like me. Sometimes, you know, not always. I mean, some of these people are so ungrateful, but often it's fine. You know, often I can tell, you know, these are sick people, and they really are, they're doing the best they can with what they got. I learned that early on about my dad. He was doing the best he could with what he had. He didn't do, you know, what I wanted him to do, and I wished he was different, and I wished I had a different upbringing. But, you know, here I am. I mean, I'm a pretty successful person in my life and my skin, and I feel pretty good about myself. And, you know, I have life challenges. I had a relationship, and I'm splitting up in that relationship just this week. So, you know, life is here, you know, and I, through this entire thing, I mean, we've been struggling for the last 3 months, through the entire thing, drinking to treat this has not been, it hadn't come up. Now, I think about drinking every once in a while, or usually I think about smoking dope or doing speed or cocaine, especially when I hear stories from the people that I'm treating, you know, because they're just coming off a run, you know. But if I listen to the whole run, you know I really don't want that. But, you know, there's just, I don't know if you have this, but every once in a while, late at night, it's just like, oh, my God, you know, I just love to relax with a whatever. You know, I do. I call it a craving, you know. And today what I do is what I did, you know, what they taught me the first day or the first few days I was there is that I don't drink or use any mood-altering drugs no matter what. You know, simple stuff. No matter what. And I don't favorably entertain taking a drink or a drug. So if that desire comes up, it's not something that I play with. It's not an option for me today. You know, I don't want what that offers, because if I did a drink or a drug, it would temporarily relieve whatever I had. And it's not like I don't want temporary relief, but I know what's on the other side. For me, any time I did alcohol or drugs, as, you know, sort of like here to there, and it was, when can I do it again? And usually it was right there, you know, to try and get the buzz going, and it was gone. You know, I don't know about you, but my buzz didn't last all that long towards the end. It was, you know, get high, yeah, and then, you know, stay high, and in nothing, you know, compulsive. I was so compulsive about cocaine that we went on a vacation with another couple. We're in the car at Kingman. We're driving to Palm Springs or wherever the hell. I had somewhere Mesquite, somewhere 90 miles away, 100 miles away, and I realized that I had left my drugs at home. And it was like, we got to turn around. And they're like, you know, man, you're crazy. We're not turning around. We got dinner reservation, blah, blah, blah. So I called a guy. I had him break into my house, get my drugs, and mail them to me on the plane. I mean, he put them on the plane in a box, and I went and picked them up at the airport. I swear to God, because I couldn't go on vacation without my drugs, you know. And today, I'm free, you know. I don't have that compulsive need to change my mood. Doesn't mean I don't want to. Doesn't mean I don't want to escape from what's happening in my life today. But I don't have to do that today. And I don't want to do that today. Because if I do that, it's only going to be followed by that ongoing need to do it again and feel bad about myself. And, I'm so grateful and blessed, you know. The last thing I want to talk about is God, you know. I mean, I believe that I'm here because I'm blessed by God. And I don't know what God is. You know, Buddhists has a different conception of God, whether it's me inside, whether it's you, whether it's, you know, all of us together, whether it's a power up in the heavens. But I know there's a force in my life, and I believe there's a force in the universe that drives us to do well, to do the right thing, to help each other. You know, I don't think we want to be mean to each other. I know I don't want to be mean to anybody. I'm mean to people, but I don't want to be that way. And, you know, I try and do God's will. And I learned about God, really. I learned most of what I know about God in these rooms. And I'm so grateful for that and grateful for an opportunity to talk for a while and have you listen and experience your love. So thank you.